times of being discreet.
Something like that, yeah. So it's, I mean, the way I planned the talk was more appropriate in the smaller room where I, you know, this is somehow more formal and it was meant to be. Yeah, right. And it's meant to be an informal.
We will do what we can to intimidate.
All right. So, I mean, this is all motivated. It came out of post-mortem discussions about after the formal conference ended last week and the questions that were in everybody's mind about whether this is a field and what makes it a field. And if it is a field, I maintain that, I don't know if it's a field, but I maintain it was a field, at least. Which is a different perspective. I.e., there's a body of results that have been, that we have managed collectively to accomplish, starting, I don't know when you want to date the first paper in the field, whether you want to call G.I. Taylor the first patent information person, I think probably sure. He deserves the honor. But starting from there and up to the modern present day, there are a whole body of results that we have now assimilated and we carry in our minds that unfortunately the rest of the general is still not part of the general education of your standard physics person, which is our fault. But nonetheless, there is a body of knowledge out there, a set of standard of way of thinking, a set of standard results and ideas and models and stuff that we can map and use to understand various problems. And if we're going to continue being a field, it's because not only are we going to rush off and do, you know, pattern information of this system and pattern information of that system, but always try to bring, abstract from all those lovely examples, the fundamental ideas, either, you know, a new knowledge about old problems or new mechanisms that we knew, tricks or new motifs, as Escher would say, that we hadn't understood before. For example, like, there's one motif, for example, which in the context of chemistry, chemical patterns is sort of a little obscure, but in biology, you can't live without it, right? The concept of an excitable, of propagation of an excitable media is something which, you know, is you get that in bizarre KPZ reactions, you know, which it took, what? BZ reaction. BZ, boy, I'm getting senile. BZ reactions and stuff like that, which, you know, some, you have to be an obscure Russian working away in the depths of wherever in order to come up with such a strange reaction. But in the context of biology, it's everywhere. Almost all biological systems that have waves are excitable media. So that's something that even if we hadn't come across it in the context of chemistry, even if B and Z hadn't done their famous work, we would have to invent it anyway, right? So that's a thing. I mean, the whole concept of front propagation in general is one of the unifying concepts of this field, right? That's something that we all see, all deal with all the time. And there are general issues of front propagation that, you know, have to be, you know, that you since you encounter them everywhere, but you have to, you know, what makes us able to deal with it is because we have this wide experience of knowing that there are fronts in this system and that system, and we have a language for talking and analyzing those things. And in particular, so one of the new motifs, or one of the most important motifs in biology, or something that we don't encounter, for example, usually, that we do also in you know, chemical patterns or solidification patterns, even though we do, as we'll point out, is the concept of discreteness, or the problem of discreteness. Whereas it's something that we can more or less ignore in general, in our general day-to-day pattern life. If we're doing biological systems, it's something that we can't ignore. And but it rears its ugly head in different ways depending on what kind of front propagation we're talking about, because we know there are different kinds of fronts. Basically speaking, there are, I claim, three kinds of fronts that are important to talk about. There's propagation into a metastable phase, where you have a stable phase invading a metastable phase. And as a subset, we'll put excitable media down here, even though it's really not that. But in terms of its front propagation properties, it basically is. There's propagation into unstable phases, and there's propagation into, let's call it super unstable. And I'll explain what that means in a second. All right, now, as far as propagation, the effects of discreteness on this, it's in principle boring. In other words, there are the effects of if you have a parameter characterizing the concentration of the whatever objects that are that discrete, if the concentration is large enough, it behaves just like the continuum does. And in principle, the corrections are small if the concentration is large. Typically, your typical 1 over the square root of n type corrections that we know and love from statistical mechanics. Now, unfortunately or fortunately, in biological systems, sometimes n is really very small. And then even in these systems, you have to really deal with it. So if you're talking about the calcium waves, the fact that you really only have a few receptors that are able to open up and release calcium means that really you can't ignore the effect of discreteness even that, even though if the concentration of such receptors was channels or whatever was large enough, then in fact it would be you could just take your standard continuum differential reaction diffusion equations and go away and proceed merrily along. Because n is really small in those systems, you have to deal with that. But in principle, that's we understand that more or less. That's not so bad. Things get more.
You could say it's not so much whether it's bad or good, but it's basically like noise.
Right. It's.
So it's either hard or
easy.
But
right.
It's like noise.
Right. It's something we understand the effects right in principle, and then if n is very small, you just have to do a simulation, or there's nothing. The continual reaction equation doesn't work, but we didn't expect it to work when n was 2 or 3 or.
But there's only in between. I mean, yes, n is very small. It's basically average killed by noise.
Right.
By noise. But if n is very large, it's not. If there's a lot in between, very, very difficult.
Right. True.
Conceptually, it's one class of things where we can understand it by noise, and now
right.
You're about to tell us that there's another.
The class where you can't.
Understand it.
Right. And that's so. Unstable phases, all right, which is number 2 on the agenda. And here, noise is more fundamental, I claim, and I hope to convince you, than it is our discreteness, in other words, than it is in the case of the metastable phases. So for that, we need an example. So so the classic example is an infection model. Which is A plus B goes to 2A. All right, in other words, say in 1D, you've got a lattice and you've got a bunch. You start out with a world filled with B particles. So I should actually write them as Bs. That would make my life easier. And then you introduce 1A particle at this end. And what happens now? They're all diffusing merrily along. This A particle and this B particle hit each other, and the B turns, gets infected, if you will, becomes an A, becomes sick, and now you have 2A particles, and so forth and so on, and that progresses down, and so you get a wave of infection. Right? All the Bs are converting into As as time goes on. Now, so the question is, now you have a front. So we're dealing with front propagation. Question is, what is the speed of the front? Now, this was worked out. The model in this form was studied by Blumen, among others. But you know, it's not that. I'm sure it existed from the dawn of time. What is the velocity of such a front? Well, it's easy to work out. No, this is propagation to an unstable phase. Why? Because I put an A here, and now it converts. It doesn't, any small perturbation here will have dramatic effects. There's no minimum excitation necessary in order to get the thing started. Well, in fact, as we'll see, let's hold that thought in abeyance because I just lied, but I want to correct the lie a little later. Okay. Now, so how do we proceed? It's obvious how we proceed. We write down a reaction diffusion equation for A's and B's. So we have the concentration of A's, which we'll call A, and we have a field of concentration of B's, which we'll call B. And how does A behave? Well, A diffuses. So we got this. That's pretty simple. And now A's and B's react. And they create more A's. So we have something that looks like that. Right? That says an A meets a B at a given site and turns into an A. Okay, and now we look down the equation for B's. B. And the same B that turned into an A, so now the number of B's is decreased by the same amount. The number of A's and B's total is conserved. So therefore, which you can derive by just adding those two equations, and you find that A plus B dot satisfies a diffusion equation. So if the concentration of A's and B's total was uniform at time 0, this is 0. And right? And so the number of total number of A's and B's is conserved. Wonderful. And so this is a constant. A plus B is a constant. I'm going to call it C. Total concentration. Okay? And now I can eliminate B. B is just CT minus A. And lo and behold, I have the Fisher equation, or the KPP equation, or the KPP-Fisher equation, however you want to call it. Right? And now, we know everything there is to know about this equation, more or less. In fact, what do we know? We know that a wave, this thing has propagating waves. And in fact, if you start from any reasonable initial condition, the wave propagates at a well-determined velocity, which is called the Fisher velocity. And that Fisher velocity is that. Okay? Well known result. Now. Yeah. Yeah, if I start out from a system where B was uniform at time equals 0, then it stays uniform everywhere, and then I have this. All right. And if not, because it's just diffusing, the total concentration, even if I didn't start out with a totally uniform, because of diffusion, it does spread out. So at long times, it looks like this anyway. So this is right. Okay. Now, so we have a beautiful result here. And now we go to the simulation. We go to this discrete little process that Blumen looked at. And Blumen looked at it, did a little computer simulation, not hard to do, and determined that the velocity is nothing like that. In fact, the velocity in this model is linear in CT. It is not proportional to the square root. All right? And what is the argument? The argument is trivial, as all good arguments are. The idea is, how does an A turn into a B? Well, A has to diffuse until it hits a B. All right? So how long does that take? Well, we know that the time is just the length squared that it has to travel divided by a diffusion constant. Right? That's how long it's going to take this A to find this B. All right? Now, what's the length? How long does it have to travel? 1 over the concentration. All right? Now, from that, we can get a velocity. The velocity is length over time, and therefore is length squared. So we have length over length squared, and now we put the d upstairs. So this is d over l is dc, as claimed. Right? Nothing like what we derived from the mapping to the Fisher equation. So the question is what happens? Right? Why does this look nothing like this? All right. And in fact, if you graph, so what happens, in fact, to understand this, you can now make a slightly different, you just have to changed one thing in this model, which when Blumen wrote down the model, they were hard. In fact, A plus B always went to 2A. But let's make it that A plus B goes to 2A with some probability K, which is this K I wrote down, reaction constant, and let A's and B's walk over each other. All right? So in fact, they have no problem. You can have 15 A's at a site. You can think of them as people in houses or whatever, just to make if it bothers you that you have many particles on a site. All right? And now, let's vary the concentration. The concentration doesn't have to be, one per every 10 sites. You can have the average concentration being 50 particles per site. There's no problem with that. Right? And because K is a small number, right, everything doesn't happen instantaneously. It takes a long time, even if K's and B's are at the same site. Because K is now a small number, it takes a while before they all interact and the A's infect the B's, because it's not the infection is not perfect anymore. And now you can graph the velocity as a function, say, of the concentration or the diffusion constant, as you will. And you find that indeed it grows linearly for small concentrations, as Mr. Blumen claimed. And then for large concentrations, it crosses over and becomes square rootish. It goes over to the square root.
If you let them go through each other, how do you define the product?
What?
If you let them go through each other, how do you define the product?
No, because they are still a. What happens? Graph the concentrations of A's and B's. The A's look like that, right? The B's look like that, right? The sum of these two is this constant here. In my brilliant graphics. And the front, you define 50-50, that's a front, wherever those two things cross. Right?
It's not a problem.
Or you can define it, right, or you could, right. Okay, so now, what's happening? Why does the predictions of the Fisher equation are so far off for small concentrations from the predictions of Mr. Blumen? Well, DeRita came along and said, it's even worse than you think. Because DeRita said, let's go out here, where C is large. And so the velocity, in fact, is becomes Fisher. And ask the simple question, how far is it off from Fisher? All right? We have discrete particles, and what effect does that have in the limit where this is a small effect, because say there are 1,000 particles per site or something crazy like that? What is the correction to Fisher? So that's the question. So we know here we get, asymptotically, we get V Fisher, and the question is, how do we get there? And so DeRita asked this question. And he measured it and found that the correction, and we'll start at the end, he found that the V was V Fisher times 1 minus. Okay, so far so good. And the answer was, asymptotically, that. All right. Ln squared c, right? So the correction is not 1 over c or 1 over the square root of c even. It's 1 over ln c, which means that even if c is 1,000, ln c is only 8 or something. And so you have 10 here, 5 over 6 over 64. It's a huge correction. And so it's not the 1 over square root of c that we know and love from statistics, from standard looking up in about, stochastic processes in your standard textbook. It's a huge correction. It's anomalously large. And how did he get this? And so now where does this come from? So DeRita said, I don't know how to do the problem, but I'm going to cheat. What is the problem? The problem is, where does the Fisher velocity come from? This wonderful result that we can write down analytically, so it's a very simple result. Where did it come from? It comes because the velocity is completely determined by the structure of the leading edge only. That's why it's so simple. Right? All you have to do to get this is look at the solution. The solution has some nonlinear form which you can't even write down in an exact, you can't write down the analytic form for that solution here because it's a complicated nonlinear thing. But in the leading edge, it's an exponential. And that's all you have to know is how that exponential dies in order to produce this result. Okay. So everything about the Fisher velocity is determined in the leading edge. But the leading edge in the Fisher equation is very different than the leading edge in the stochastic simulation. In the stochastic simulation, in fact, the leading edge is compact. There is always a last particle, right? Because the number, the A's come in discrete packets, right? And so there is no exponential tail out to infinity. There is an exponential tail which gets cut off because beyond some point, there are no more A's, right? So the front is compact, whereas the Fisher front is a beautiful exponential. And since everything is being determined by the nature of that exponential, you're getting it wrong. At least you're getting it partially wrong. Because it's mostly exponential it's exponential for a while, you get something close to Fisher if, you know, depending on how far you are down. And the log has to do with, you know, how far out on that exponential you're allowed to go before the description you wrote down was wrong. Yeah.
He decides also for case two, because case two is.
Yeah. He didn't, but I did, and it's all written down. But.
The correction.
It's not Lon squared. It's power law. It's some power law. Right, it's some power law you can write down, which is case two is not this bad. Case two is more like right, because it's right. Okay. So what did he do? He said, "I don't know how to solve the problem, so I'm going to cheat. I know that what's going wrong is I'm." Describing the front, the leading edge, wrong. So let me see how sensitive things are to what's going on in the leading edge. So you take the Fisher equation, all right, which lets okay, let's rescale the concentration. Let's leave it the way it is at the moment. All right, that was the Fisher equation, plus. And he said, let's put here a theta function of A minus 1. Okay, means that, okay, I can't prevent the particles from diffusing out. That's hard for me to do. But at least let me say that these particles that are diffusing out don't have any effect, don't have any real effect on the propagation of the front, because they're not going to infect any B's. So these, you know, sort of virtual particles out, you know, because once A is less than 1, then there really is no particles out there. It's all a figment of our mathematical imagination, because we know the front is really compact. So, the diffusion equation insists that A continue dying exponentially, but let's say those A particles that really aren't there have no effect. Sounds a little weird, but okay. Let's rescale things now. Let's just rescale the A field to 1, and then this becomes, we can write it that way. And then we can call the 1 over C, which is a small number. Let's call it epsilon for the moment. Right? So now A varies between 0 and 1, and if A drops below epsilon, then the production of A's gets cut off. Right? And now this problem you can solve analytically. And what you find is that with this analytic problem. And that's a real result. It's a real result for a wrong model, but it's a real result. Okay? And then he argues, well, the effect of this cutoff mimics somehow the finite concentration, the fact that
it's no wronger, it's less wrong than the Fisher model.
Right. It's closer in truth to the Fisher model.
To the
discrete model. Right. If you now
any other ad hoc approximation. In other words, the Fisher model is exact in some limit. this model doesn't have to ever be exact. And yet it works.
And in fact works in the sense that it agrees with
it. Okay, well let me address that. All right. Now so that was and now you go ahead and you check it and you find it more or less works, but doesn't work really great. I.e. that you plot a graph with the correction of, so now you write V minus V Fisher, say, times log squared C, right? Which is supposed to be pi squared over 2, this wonderful number, as a function of, say, log C. Right? So now you go ahead and you measure this, and you find that it's increasing. Here's pi squared over 2. It increasing slowly. And if you are really strong like Herbie was, you can go out to 10 to the 20th here. Or Leonid Pechenik was, Herbie's student, actually managed to go out to 10 to the 20. And then, in fact, he got to like 75% of pi squared over 2 or something like that. 80%, some number like that. Right? It still wasn't at pi squared over 2. In fact, this thing was, in log C, it was only converging logarithmically in log C. Really disgusting. But it turns out, in fact, we discovered just this year, that if you don't say that epsilon is 1 over C, you say that epsilon is 4 over C, in fact, then you get numerically wonderful results. Rigorously, the change of here, because that you put that in the log and now you expand, you see that it's a higher order correction. But it's a very, numerically, it's a very relevant higher order correction. But what's truly amazing, just from, Ripley's Believe It or Not, that if you let this be a free parameter and now just pick it from the simulations, you can do wonderful all the ways down to C's of order, 3 or 4. It works. If you do that, that's just numerical magic for people who love numerical magic. If you just take the 1 over epsilon, then you have to go higher orders in this expansion to get anything. If you just arbitrarily replace that by 4 over C, then it works down to C's of order 1.
It's just accident, or if you do an expansion near the fixed point at infinity and you have to take a circle of certain lengths, to say that that's the cutoff according to the exponent.
Since we don't understand, the problem is we don't understand where this cutoff came from in any deep sense. It was all, wonderful, hand-waving, beautiful type arguments like that. Since it's all, seat of the pants flying, you can do what the heck, you can maybe yes, maybe no. We don't have any way of even knowing how to calculate the mapping. Because we didn't derive this mapping to the cutoff, from the discrete model to the cutoff theory. We just wrote it down ad hoc because we don't have any tools to be able to treat it the way it should be treated.
Right? If I could address, this is a little off the subject, but there are cases, of course, which you could treat
exactly as you know.
Yeah.
And if you go back to the original Blum and Sokolov model.
But none that have the crossover.
Indeed.
Right. The only models you can treat models. There are models. There are more than one. There are like three or four that I know of, models where the behavior is exactly CD times a number which you can calculate. Which is model dependent.
Let me just say something. I'm guilty of one of those.
Yeah, I am aware of that.
The mechanism that we adduce for that is really completely different from what you've been talking about.
Right.
The small number limit, because we took k equal 1. Okay, so it's completely different. It has nothing to do with this.
Of course, because the language you use has to do with what you're expanding around. Right? You're in the what we can call the reaction controlled limit, the diffusion controlled limit, where everything is this question of how long the part A takes to meet B. That's diffusion controlled, and then you get this. And if that's always the rate determining mechanism, that's like in the original Blumen model, that's all there is in life. Right? Which is what you proved.
You think your Blumen collaborator is a little more credible than the thing. So it's
So, I mean, you can look up all that. I mean, this is not an, this is, we're not here to give, historical credit to all particular players. All right. But there is no exact model. There is no exactly solvable model that gets this whole crossover from the reaction, from the diffusion controlled regime to what you might call the reaction controlled regime. There's just no, we don't have, there's no model that shows, we don't have any, a single model which has this crossover. And so we are completely at a loss to say what's going on beyond this. We just don't have the tools. And we need the tools, but we don't have them. And this is where things are. But in any case, what we've learned from this is that here, the discreteness of the fact that A's come in discrete units has a strikingly large effect, not just 1 over square root of C, things that we sort of can handle and have gotten used to, but 1 over log C, which means that C has to be huge for any, for these corrections to be small. But furthermore, what has it done? In fact, it's changed the nature of the model. The discreteness, in fact, is a singular perturbation of the model. Why? Because there are different ways to see it. One is the fact that the nature of the front is, in fact, compact versus exponential. That's one way to say it. I mean, the fact that it's singular is clear because this is a non-analytic sort, very non-analytic sort of thing, which is indication that it's singular. Another way to prove that it's singular is, in words, what's the problem? The lie I mentioned to Gunther about 10 minutes ago. Namely, I said that it's an unstable propagation into an unstable phase. Propagation into an unstable phase means that an infinitesimal perturbation sets off the growth of the new phase, right? But there is no infinitesimal
in the reaction
in the equation, in the Fisher equation, there is, but in this discrete particle model, there is no such thing as an infinitesimal perturbation. You need a whole A, and that's a finite perturbation. So in fact, you're now propagating to what you some kind of metastable phase, because you need a finite excitation in order to get things started. So it's changed the nature of the thing. If you look at the another way to say it, which is again equivalent, if you look at the nature of the solution space for steady state traveling solutions of this equation, once you put in the cutoff, no matter how small the cutoff is, which is the sign of any single good singular perturbation, there is a unique steady state traveling solution whose velocity is, as advertised, that. Right? In the original Fisher equation, we know that, in fact, there existed a whole family of traveling solutions, of which the one with the Fisher one, for interesting reasons which are connected to this, because the initial condition, in fact, the fact that the initial condition fell off quickly enough was another kind of singular perturbation of the problem. That's why it picked out the Fisher velocity out of all those things. But if you just look at the steady state equation, there was an infinite range of steady state velocities possible. The fact that the solution space has now changed, discontinuously by the introduction of this epsilon means it's a singular perturbation. All right? So discreteness in these systems is a singular perturbation. It cannot be ignored. Right? And then, in fact, it's so singular that there's another regime, Lenz regime, or Blumen's regime or whatever, where, in fact, the language that you're supposed to be using is completely different. Namely, the reaction, the diffusion limited regime. All right. So much for that model.
I have a question.
Sure.
About your statement that you don't know how, that this is all just conjecture. That could be for kind of two reasons. One is, because it depends on the particular model, the particular discrete model, or because there are still universal features that don't depend on the particular way in which you discretize, and you just don't know how to extract those universal features.
All right.
In one case, you wouldn't expect.
Right.
Know how to do it, and it wouldn't matter because it would be different in each case.
Right.
And in the second case, there's still something left to do.
Right.
And so which one is it?
In this case, it's probably universal. I.e., you can put, it doesn't matter the details of how you cut this off. You can put in one of 1,000 different cutoffs. The pi squared over 2 will be the same in all cases.
And the log squared.
But
the other end of the problem, in terms of the reaction, the direct discrete reaction, there are numbers of different ones that all give the same
They all behave like CD. So the qualitative features are universal to across a whole span of discrete models, right? But even in this, at this end, the pi squared over 2 is probably true. I mean,
and the log squared,
right? And so what's the only thing we don't know is the truth is probably there's a number there which has to do with the discrete, which is formally higher order, right? Yes, right.
There is something left to prove. Not
that I couldn't do it, the reader can't do it.
Derrida could not do it.
Yeah.
He could not prove it.
Let me make another comment. You're switching away from the Fisher equation, if I understand.
I have 3 more seconds on the Fisher equation, then I'm moving on. Yes.
Okay, well, let me just say something else. There's another model you can talk about. David has not talked about noise. Are you going to talk about noise at all?
Thermal noise?
Noise.
No.
Okay, there's another equation you can solve, which is like the Fisher equation, without the phase, the Fisher equation. Only you add
noise.
Where?
Here, I'll show you. Where C is a white noise. A, 1 minus A.
An exact mathematical theorem by Newton-Euler, a collaborator, which says that it has it would probably want to have a compact support. That is, the property of the compact support, literally goes to zero. It stochastic, but literally goes to zero in probability. And there's recent results from Euler and During and Smerin, which say that if you take this equation, you can get some more exact results, but never mind.
Right. But they don't have the velocity yet.
Wait. Numerically solve it.
We solve it numerically. The 10 to the 20th number
comes from
the code who solved that equation.
Yes.
Okay. So we did it and it works. But there's
what you got and what they got also is consistent. It's consistent with the log squared.
Yeah.
That's when David said my stack student went to 10 to the 20th, we didn't do it in the discrete process by having 10 to the 20th.
Yeah, I can only do up to 10 to the 15th with the discrete process.
We did it in terms of this PDE and stuff like that.
Noise plays a, how all this goes together is still...
Yeah. Okay, before you leave the future, one more thing. Did you try, because since Len mentioned the compact support, if you turn the diffusion term that you have, the nonlinear diffusion, produces
compact, right?
What?
Yeah.
Which have compact support.
Right.
Still, they behave like Fisher in the sense that you have continuous family of different velocities.
It's like type 2. It's like type 2.
It's type 2, but it's somewhat different because it's compact support. And I wonder, because what you mentioned, the argument, also in this case, it should be the discreteness singular.
Yeah, but less singular than this.
Yeah, but that's not exactly type 2. Type 2 means that you change the reaction term.
I know, but
it's not equivalent to change the reaction
term. Yeah, so nobody. You haven't looked at the cutoff and the nonlinear diffusion. That's the first thing you should do, right?
No, the nonlinear diffusion.
With a cutoff.
When you add the cutoff to the nonlinear diffusion, it doesn't seem, at least from the numerics we did, but that was for different model, it didn't seem to make as strong effect.
Right, because if it's type 2, then it won't be log squared.
It's not type 2. It's not type 2. Type 2...
this is for outside, not for here.
That's but you confuse the audience.
Type 2
means that the reaction is.
Yeah, the image, right. All right. One last word about this, about Fisher, before we move on. We can do this problem, this Blumen models, you know, with the finite concentration, our little version of it, in 2D, right? Where we fill up the whole universe with Bs and then inject a bunch of As at this side, right? So we just made the dimension now one bigger. And now you get a propagating front, right? You get a, this line now propagates, right? So far, so good. And obviously, the propagation speed is the same as the 1D case, so that's trivial, right? But the question is this front stable to transverse oscillations? Now, if you look at the stability of the Fisher equation, of the original Fisher equation, the answer is those fronts are stable for all parameters. Without exception, without question. All right? If, however, you look at the equation with the Rita's cutoff in, then, and we do the stability calculation, then you find that for some range of parameters, something like if the diffusion constants of A and B are different in particular, and A is slower than B, and this is less than something like 1 over log epsilon, log C, shall we say, then, in fact, the front is unstable. And then, all right, with that's a mathematically rigorous statement about the cutoff equation. If you then go use the Derrida mapping to talk about the particle simulation, you would expect, again, that, in fact, this front should go unstable if the concentration is low enough. And, in fact, it does. So there is something to the mapping. The mapping is not, you know, tells you the truth, but it still lacks some kind of solid foundation from, you know, I'm too mathematically oriented to be happy with just, you know, let's throw in a cutoff just for the hell of it. All right, end of discussion of this class. One last thing. In fact, if dA is 0, this model is, in fact, just dLA. Right? Because all you have, that's DLA is an infection model where the infected particles no longer move. Right? Particles come in, walk around, they hit an A, they turn into aggregate, which is an A particle, and they just sit there forever. That's DLA. Right? So in fact, we've gone all the way to DLA. And in fact, this answered a big question I never understood about DLA. Because DLA was supposed to be a model for solidification. Solidification is growth into a metastable phase. That we all know and love. We understand that perfectly well. But this model, at its mean field description, looked like propagation into an unstable phase. And I never understood that. It always bothered me, even though I couldn't even vocalize, but it always bothered me, you know, that there was something wrong. And the answer is that the fact that you have discrete particles makes it propagation into a metastable phase. As long as the concentration of the particles is small enough, et cetera, it actually acts like propagation to a metastable phase. And that is the right words. And that's why it is a reasonable model for solidification. But it's very subtle. OK, enough of that. Now let's move to the last thing, what I call the super unstable thing. And this brings us to the subject of the talk I gave during the conference. But now let me change the emphasis from the biology type things to the issues question. So if you remember the model there, was you have a bunch of people, you have n people, each characterized by a number, a fitness x, right, which is the number of ones in their genome. So x is a number between 0 and L. Right? And now you have the rule that each person reproduces at rate x. So at the mean field reaction diffusion level, you have that p of x dot is xp. Each person is reproducing with the rate x. All right? You have death, which is indiscriminate. So everybody has the same death rate, which is the average, the same as the average growth rate in order to keep the population balanced. in size. All right, and now you have mutations. Mutations change x, so x can go to x plus and minus 1 by mutations at a rate mu. And in so you get something like mu x p double prime. And now the fact is, however, that the rates, the plus and minus 1, are not the same because, in fact, you're always more likely to go to the 50-50 state because the guy who's all 1s has to go down and the guy who's all 0s has to go up. So there's a drift term here which is up to sign something like something like this, which means there's a drift toward the 50-50 state. Okay. That's the mean field description of this equation. And now, the question is, what does this mean field description have to do with the real simulation? Just the same way, what does the Fisher equation have to do with the Blumen model, with the infection model? All right. And as I mentioned during my talk, in fact, for reasonable values of n, the answer is they have nothing to do. The phenomenology of this equation and the phenomenology of the discrete model are just completely far. They have nothing to do with each other, basically. The time scale is all wrong. The dependencies.
N is the
N is the integral of p. Yeah, the number of people. Okay, and notice n doesn't even appear here. There's no independence, right?
That's why.
Because this is a linear equation in p. You can rescale p, no problem. The scale of p has no effect. It's not even a nonlinear equation. It's better. It's easier than Fisher, because this is a linear equation, and that's why it can be solved out analytically. Even, I mean, it's really pathetic. Right? This has absolutely no independence. And so the first strong prediction of this equation is that there is no independence. And that's wrong. Well, it's true if n, as I said, was e to the l. At some point, if you make n bigger than 10 to the 50th, at that point, there is no longer an independence. Great. But for normal values of n, there's a very strong independence, which is completely missed. And that's all, everything is determined by that independence. Right? And is missing completely. So what do you do? So,
I think you better say why this is super unstable.
Okay, why is it super unstable? Why is this different than Mr. Fisher? In Mr. Fisher, we had that p dot was p in the far field, right? In the leading edge, p dot, right, went like p times some number, k times kp. And therefore, the unstable phase grew exponentially at some predetermined rate, with some predetermined exponential growth rate. Here, the growth rate is a function of x. So this point, so if we have a leading edge now, this point is growing with rate as e to the xt, x1t. This point out here is growing like e to the x2t. This one is not growing at the same rate as this, and therefore everything is more or less in balance. It's slightly wrong, but we can live with it. This one is growing exponentially faster than this point. This one wins. But then this one's growing even faster. And there's no end to the story. Well, there is an end to the story because in this finite system, in fact, you can't get bigger than L. That's why eventually, and if N is big enough, you know, you run out. You know, there's an end to this thing.
This the reason that you say that it scales like n to the size of the system, because the highest growing mode at n.
Well, it doesn't grow like n to the size of the system. It grows like ln n, as we will see.
Because before you had ln of the cutoff.
Right. Right. Exactly. But you're getting ahead of me. All right. So that's why I call this super unstable, because it's not unstable with a uniform growth rate. It's unstable with a growth rate which gets worse and worse as you go out on the leading edge. So in fact, the further you go on the leading edge, the more important it is to the dynamics. But that's all a lie, because there's nobody out there. Because again, the front is compact. There are n people, there's a person with a maximum fitness at any given time, the front is compact, always. Right? And here, before in Fisher, it makes a small mistake. Here, it's everything. All right? So one way to diagnose it is to do what we did in the Fisher equation. In fact, the historical chain of events is, in fact, backwards. Because, in fact, we put in a cutoff in this equation, and then Derrida saw that and said, let me do it for the Fisher equation. But that's, you know, the way life works. So what we should do is take the growth terms.
And to be fair, Alan Perlson.
And Alan Perlson, actually, we stole the idea from Alan Perlson. So, yes. Right?
We didn't steal from Alan Perlson. We stole it from the DLA paper.
Who stole it from Alan Perlson? Yeah, whatever. Right. Right. In fact, just as a historical side note, in fact, DLA, if you write the original thing that Nauenberg and Sander wrote down for mean field DLA, in fact, if you look at the behavior in the far field, it has a growth rate, which is, again, XP. Because the Walker density goes like X out, right? Where X measures the downstream thing, right? There's a constant flux, an incoming flux. So therefore, the A field goes like X. The background A field goes like X. And the growth of the aggregate is proportional to the Walker density. And therefore, again, it has exactly this symptomology, right? And therefore, DLA, in fact, at least in its mean field description, is, again, super unstable, which is why that the mean field that they wrote down was of no use, because it just doesn't describe the right physics. You're just getting the physics all wrong. OK, so what can you do? You can put in a cutoff. And now, again, we don't know, since we don't know how to derive the cutoff, we don't know exactly how to put in a cutoff. And we can put in, actually, what we did back then, for reasons which escape, except it was mathematically made a nicer model, is we took this whole equation here, and we multiplied this by theta of p minus 1. Again. All right? So we again said that there's no growth out in the far field. There are, you know, the diffusion equation insists that there be somebody out there, but they're not real, so we won't let them have any children. We can castrate them. That's the least we can do, right? So you can then analyze this equation, and you find that the velocity.
There's no parameter.
Now there's a parameter, because now n is a parameter, you see. Because now the
scaling.
Because of the scaling.
If you mean a renormalized p minus 1 over n.
Yeah. Right. So if you renormalize, you would get p minus 1 over n. Right. Right. Now you find that the v goes like ln n, if you analyze this equation, to the one third. Right, Herbie? One third. All right. Now, at the time, I looked at this and said, this is crazy. Because what happens in the limit? It diverges. Right? You can't, as opposed to Derrida, where they had at least a finite limit when n went to infinity, you got the Fisher velocity. Right? Here, there is no finite limit when n goes to infinity. It diverges. I said to Herbie, this is absolute garbage. And therefore, we went off on a completely different trail, which is much more similar to Lenz's treatment of the Blumen model. We looked at the exact opposite limit, which was a small mu limit where everything was diffusion controlled. All right? And it's rigorous. The results we got were rigorous in that limit. But in fact, if you plot the velocity as a function of n, what you find is that for small n, it's linear, which is like the linear C dependence in the Blumen model. And then it goes over to this, I don't know how to draw a log to the one-third, but it grows over to this very slowly growing function of n. Right? Unfortunately, when we did simulations of the model, we only looked out to here, and everything seemed to be linear in n, and we were happy. And we thought that was the end of the story. So that was how we ended the story back then. In fact, the story is, of course, more complicated, but I don't have time to describe all the details, but that's basically the story. We saw this, we were happy, and then we put it aside and, you know, went on to bigger and better things. All right, but in fact, if you just run the simulations out longer, in fact, there is a log to the one-third. It's not log to the one-third, in fact. The behavior here is not log to the one-third. It fits better to log n. It's not log to the one-third, it's log n. What happened is recently there was a paper by this gang of three, Ruzin, who's a physicist, and there and two biologists, Wakely and Coffin. And basically they took our model and said, wait a minute. They made two changes. They said, first of all, why did you put the cutoff on the death term? It's good to have, in fact, people out there do die. Because if I should mutate way out in head, right, most likely any straggler who mutates out in front will die because of selection effects. He won't, because when I pick randomly to kill people, he will die because there's only one of him out there, and so it's so easy for him to die. So in fact, you shouldn't cut off the death term. You should only cut off the birth term, because that's the dangerous term. You should leave this term the way it was. And then he pointed out that, in fact, if you do simulations of the model on a discrete lattice as opposed to the continuum, that's also something you should think about. And when all is said and done, he did simulations of now of this model discretized and found that, in fact, the velocity went like log n. And in fact, that's what the simulations show. So in fact, he's closer to the truth than this cutoff, you see, is different than our cutoff.
I didn't understand the discrete lattice. The simulations were on the lattice?
The simulations are, of course, on the lattice. X is a discrete number, 1, 2, 3, up to n, all. Right? And the question is, what is, you have this waveform that's propagating, and how sharp is it? Is it extend, or is this leading edge, which is what's important, does it extend over a lot of latticites, in which case you can write down continuum equations, there exist derivatives of it, or is it in fact a sudden sort of, you know, drop? And he says the drop is so quick, in fact, that you're not allowed to approximate discrete differences by derivatives.
In doing this calculation.
In doing the simulations of this equation with the cutoff. By the obvious discrete form, which is in fact what I should have written down in the beginning, but I'm too lazy, right?
Our analytic techniques always work better for.
Right, it's easier to do the calculation. You always take.
So you can't get the log to the one-third answer comes from solving it as a PDE.
Right, he has right.
Yes.
Ruzin has no calculation of this from that equation. He just has numerical solutions of this equation, and it seems to fit the line in. All right. If you take this Ruzin cutoff, in fact, and again, don't say p minus 1, or that the cutoff is 1 over p, it's in fact something like 10 over p. In fact, you can produce a cutoff model which reproduces extremely well down to n's of 100 the true simulation. So again, if you let me renormalize this cutoff, right, which for reasons that are mysterious, but if you let me do it, in fact, then I can get numerically accurate results.
Analytically?
No, numerically accurate. No. I don't have any analytic results.
I don't understand.
What? Oh, wait, I can't answer two questions. Yeah, go.
What are you comparing? You're comparing two different numerical results?
No, I have the simulations, which is the experiment, the truth, right, of the discrete model of the particles growing and living and dying, and I have this equation.
A simulation
of this equation, on a lattice, of this equation. And in fact, if you let me dial the cutoff with this fudge factor, in fact, I can map the results of the one map onto with extremely good accuracy the results of the other, for reasons that are...
The log one-third was analytic in the continuum.
Right. Now, the question is, what is the analytics of this equation, when you just put the cutoff here, does that change? Why did the one log change from one-third to one? Was it because of the discreteness of the lattice? I have a graduate student now trying to work that out, but we unknown. I don't know the answer right now. Okay. Now.
Well, we think it's from was, to be fair. I mean, we have a gap.
You have a, I mean, I don't want to. Yeah. I don't know. Probably. It could be. In fact, that's another lesson of these models that you, that's not unusual for these kinds of models, that the discreteness of the lattice is also an important effect. No. Yeah, we played with it, but we haven't systematically checked it. All right. Now, okay. So, that's one way to play the game, is to play a cutoff. However, the problem, as I said, is because we don't know how to put the cutoff in, you can put up the cutoff different ways. If you put up the cutoff the way we put the cutoff originally, it doesn't matter how you renormalize the cutoff, you can't make it match the data. And there's no choice which has anywhere near as good agreement with the actual truth, you know, microscopic simulation, if I put the cutoff the way we had originally put the cutoff in on this whole term.
Yeah, but that was just a mistake.
The mistake. Yes. Since there's no derivation, we did it ad hoc. What difference does it make? It should be universal, right?
It works better. You can come up with an argument
for it. But in fact, we know it's wrong. This is, in fact, wrong. I can prove it's wrong. How can I prove it's wrong to you? I mean, I know it's not the truth. It may produce the correct asymptotic answers for reasons which I can't justify. But I know that in fact it's wrong. One way to know in fact that it's wrong is to look at the equation for the first moment of the distribution. C1 defined, that's x bar of the population. Right? I can write down an exact differential equation for C1. C1 dot is C2 plus mu 1 minus 2 C1 over L. That's an exact equation.
In this continuum model?
No, for the microscopic dynamics. The point is that if I put this cutoff in, this equation is no longer true. It was true in the model with no cutoff, so i.e. because the mean field equations reproduce the first moment. Because that's all linear and everything. That's wonderful. So, in fact, the mean field equations reproduce this equation exactly. I put in a cutoff, they no longer reproduce it exactly. Therefore, the mean field equations are lying to me. I mean, at the grossest level. That doesn't mean that they won't get this log right in the end of the day. Just I know that it's not rigorous. It's not exact by any means. It's not the true description. In fact, Herbie and I therefore sat down and wrote down a different cutoff, which doesn't change this first moment equation, only changes the second moment equation. And tried to and worked with it. Right? And we could make up arguments why that was a better thing to do, you know, from the same kind of hand waving psychologizing of the model. I could have convinced you that we convinced ourselves that with a much thing and this is going to work better. In fact, it doesn't reproduce the model for any choice of cutoff. So the point is, I can write down 100 different cutoffs. Give me, you know, meditation room, you know, and some dark, you know, some padded walls and a bunch of paper, and I can write down 18 different cutoffs. And I can justify each one and convince you that that is the right cutoff. Some of them will work, some of them don't. I have no idea why. I don't know that it's even meaningful to discuss. Why? I don't know if it's accidental. I don't have any idea. I have no language for discussing it. I have no. Other than testing it against the actual microscopic simulations, I have nothing, no justification for one thing over another. Right? So we would like to do something better. And now this is the final thing. I take it's not a problem that I'm running over time, because I've already run over time. And that's to continue. That's the last thing I mumbled about, and nobody understood, of course, because I was mumbling at that point in my talk. Namely, let's continue down the merry road of these equations. This equation is a beautiful equation. Let's now write down the equation for C2 dot. Right? C2 dot is the variance of the population. Okay? This equation is a very nice equation. In fact, it even has a name. This is called, it expresses a principle, it has a name. It's called, well, without this term at least, it's called the fundamental theorem of natural selection. All right? Invented by Fisher. The same Fisher as the Fisher equation. Because the Fisher equation, in fact, was a model of evolution, if for those who know their history. What does this equation mean? That why is there evolution? Evolution requires two things. It requires mutations, and it requires diversity. All right? This is just the bias. So in fact, Fisher doesn't have this. This equation just says that evolution requires variance. It requires variety. If you don't have many different kinds of people to pick from, you can't pick the best. There's no survival of the fittest. There's no progress. So evolution is limited by the variety in the population. That is the fundamental theorem of natural selection. All right. We're now modified because, in fact, there's a drift due to this other effect. What is C2 dot? You write it down. You can write down exactly. C2 dot is C3, the skewness of the population, the third, the reduced third moment. Now, plus mu. So far, so good. If I had this model with no cutoffs, in fact, I would get exactly that. If I had just the differential reaction diffusion equation and look at the second moment, write down the equation for the second moment of that, I would get that. No problem. Right? But now there's an extra term. The true equation has two extra terms, in fact, minus over n and 2 C1, C2 minus C2, C3. Plus C3. Okay, this C3 over n is just a renormalization of that. That's trivial. That we can throw away. That's clearly not doing anything. But now, notice what's happening here. This thing, allow me for the moment to factorize that expectation value. Then this would say that C2 dot, in fact, is being suppressed exponentially at a rate 1 over n. So instead of being driven in a positive direction by the third moment, which is what happens in the mean field equations, in fact, it's being cut off by this term. It can't grow, right? It's being stabilized by this thing. All right. Now, you go on, and you can now write down, so far so good. Now you write down the C3 equation. You get the C3 dot is C4, and then there's another mu 1 minus 2 E1, 2 C1 over L. So far, no problem. And now they're the 1 over n corrections, and now there's something like 6 C1 C3. So the C3 moment is also being suppressed by 1 over n corrections. And so is the C4 moment, and so is the C5 moment, and so is the C6 moment. They're all being suppressed. And because there was no suppression without these terms at all, this is a singular perturbation. All right? So now, what do I do? How do I proceed? Well, the point is that, and in fact, as you go higher in the hierarchy, the suppression gets stronger and stronger, in fact. This thing grows like 2 to the n, this coefficient out here, in fact. So very quickly, in fact, there's real strong suppression of the highest moments. So at some point, the highest moments cannot do anything because they're being suppressed by a term which is 2 to the n, right? And in fact, so therefore, how big does n have to be before this is an order 1 suppression? Ln n. Ln n, right? If I go down to the kth moment where k is ln n, there's an order 1 suppression now of that term. In fact, so it never grows. It can never get off the ground. So without the 1 over n effects, all the moments go on until they bump to L. Because there's an L suppression here, like here, there's also a 1, there's a minus C2 over L term here, which suppresses it. But only when C2 is of order L, which is clearly crazy, because that means the variance is the size of the system. That's bad news. what's really providing suppression is these things. And means that at some point beyond the kth moment where k is ln n, roughly speaking, the moments have to die. They're only, in fact, the number of active moments is only ln n moments, and not L moments, which would... Now, how do I proceed? So what I can do now is take this and start just cutting it off, because at some point I know that the moments are not going to have any effect, so I just go ahead and see what happens. I cut off after the fourth moment. And now integrate this closed set of equations, because I factorize. Why do I factorize? I factorize because I can prove rigorously that formally C1, C2 is C1 times C2 plus terms which are order 1 over n. So let's assume that this is a singular perturbation for the moment, and these are regular perturbations. Right? I have no reason, I mean, that seemed reasonable at the time, so I did it. So let's throw that, right? These are just normal, regular perturbations, because once I have, like, surface tension and Healy-Shaw, once I put in one regularization, the other regularizations don't matter, because if this is a strong one, this is the one that's going to, right? What all the other microscopic effects don't matter, if I have the dominant microscopic effect. So let's throw this out. I factorize these things, and now I have a closed system of equations. I can integrate them, and they do fairly well. They do, in fact, wonderfully for n's which are reasonably large, 1,000, 2,000, up to 1,000, say. Now, in fact, I can do more. Because, in fact, what I notice, in fact, that there's a C1 here. Right? C1 is of order L. But none of the other C's are of order L. Right? And L, let's say, is big, 200, 100, 200, something like that. In fact, therefore, if I assume that C1 is of order L and all other C's are of order 1, in fact, the equations simplify dramatically. So far, so good. And I get, I can get a much simpler set of equations. And in fact, I see more than that, that there is a separation of time scales. Because this equation says that C1 changes on C1 changes by order in time of order 1. C1 changes by order 1 times, which is a small relative change in C1. So as far as all the other equations are concerned, in times of order 1, C1 is not changing at all. And therefore, I can now just, everything now is slave to C1. Everything should just be enslaved to C1, which is the mean fitness. And now C1 is a number here in all the other equations. And I can solve the other equations. And what I find, in fact, is that in times of order 1, all these derivatives go to 0. So in fact, the whole other rest of the system is just being slaved to C1. And means, which is good, because what does that mean? There's universality. That the velocity and all other features of the distribution at second moment, third moment, fourth moment, and everything else is only a function of the instantaneous C1 and of nothing else. The initial conditions play no role. Right? Otherwise, because in fact, as you saw, I have an equation where the velocity is changing as a function of time. How am I ever going to describe the system which is constantly changing and there's no steady state in this game? There's no time except for the equilibrium when nothing is changing at all. That's boring. But this whole period where things are changing, everything is changing the function of time. How could I possibly describe it? Why should it not be a function of all the initial conditions? And the answer is because everything is slaved to C1. But it's done through the 1 over n terms. In fact, the relevant parameter is not 1 over n, but L over n is the control parameter in this game. L enters through, L and N only enter in the combination L over N. So that's the control parameter. So I have universality, which is wonderful. Therefore, everything is only a function of the instantaneous C1. If I know what C1 is at any given time, I know everything. All right? Does that work? And the answer is yes. If you do look at the microscopic simulations, it works. And in fact, everything is only a function of L over N. So that is deduction from this game that in fact seems to be true numerically of the microscopic simulation. So I've already learned something that I didn't know before. And in fact, those kind of conclusions you don't get from this. In fact, there's no way that you'd see that things are only a function of L over N. They don't enter in the same place at all in that equation. So it's really bizarre. I mean, how it does so well numerically and yet... but this seems to be a rigorous result. Furthermore, and now I'm getting hopefully nearer the end. Okay, now I have reduced the problem to a set of algebraic equations, to a finite set of algebraic equations, right? And now, what is the nature of these algebraic equations? They are, you see that, okay, what do they involve? Well, C1 is now an outside parameter, and they involve C2, so C3 is now determined in terms of C2, and C4 is now determined in terms of C3, and C5, everything is determined in terms of C2. What closes it? Well, the last condition that says that C15 equals 0 is the thing that closes the system. And C2 basically is acting like an eigenvalue. That is a unique value of C2, which will make C15 equal to 0, which is the condition that I'm dropping C15 and everything's higher, say. So now C2 is an eigenvalue. And so now I have a selection problem. C2, which determines the velocity, right? The velocity is just basically C2. So I have now a velocity selection problem, which is driven by the singular parameter 1 over n, or L over n. So in fact, I claim this is very similar to dendrites, or to Safman-Taylor, where I had the velocity was an eigenvalue determined by the singular parameter. Without the singular parameter, there is no selection of C2. And it's driven by this. I can make that a little more rigorous, and then this is the last thing, and then I'll let you go for lunch, because lunchtime is approaching, and that's holy and sacred. In fact, I can write down the first, second, third, fourth, fifth, sixth, seventh moment equations. In fact, I can write down all the moment equations, and I will do that for you. Let me just... If I define the generating function of the moment equations, I have C1 through Cn, and I define C of x as a standard generating function of the moment, I can write down an equation for...
Y. That's not to do with x.
What? X. This, oh, yeah, let's call it, well, let's call it y. Fine. Has nothing to do with the real x. Okay? I can define this generating function, and now I can write down the differential equation for the generating function. It looks like the following thing. C double prime, which is C dt of y, equals mu cosh y minus 1 plus C2y, which is the eigenvalue, all right, plus epsilon, which is L over n, times e to the d of y minus 1. Now, what's d of y? D of y equals the sum of ck, y to the k, 2 to the k minus 2 over k factorial. So up to a factor, right? Or in other words, another way of writing this, this is c of 2y minus 2c of y. Right? That's what it is. So I have this function which is determined in terms of c. If I know the function c of y, I know the function d of y. It's some transform of it in some bizarre sense. So now, this is an equation, a non-local eigenvalue equation for the function c. That's what follows from all the moments. You just take all the moment equations, sum them up, multiply by x, y to the k, and you get that equation.
This is exact?
That is an exact reproduction of these equations, yeah.
No, but you've done it.
After, I can write down the full one. I've dropped the terms which don't have the L over N, which I claim are small. I can write down the full one for you. I mean, I just, and this is hard, complicated enough for you. I don't want to.
So this is the same approximation of
the right. All it assumes.
Thing as
all it assumes is factorization.
Right.
That I allow to factorize the moment. That's the assumption.
Right. So that has
effect. That's the assumption in this. And I mean, this one has a few other terms dropped, which I claim are small, but I can write them down for you. That doesn't change anything. The important thing is the factorization. All right? So now I have everything is reduced to solving a simple differential equation. Well, not such a simple differential equation. All differential equations are simple, right? But this is, in fact, a particularly difficult simple differential equation. What? It's not even local, right? And in fact, it's not obvious how C2 is acting like an eigenvalue. How do I know that C2 is acting like an eigenvalue? Why does there exist a solution only for a unique value of C2, which is what I'm claiming? Right? In fact, I've spent the last 3 months slaving over this equation. There's a lot of meat in this equation. It's a beautiful equation. What? It's an integral differential equation. Right. I mean, if it was just a differential equation, it would have taken me a week, right? But 3 months is because it's got meat in it. It's really, and it's like the equation for the final equation you write down for Safman-Taylor, right? You write it down in the complex plane. It's an integral differential equation, whatever. You write it down as a boundary integral. You write down some eigenvalue equation for the problem, right? And then you have to solve it. And it's just now a question of how smart you are, you know, how much progress you can make in solving that equation. If you're, you know, Pomo or whatever, you can, you know, get pretty far. If you're us, you can get some scaling information. You know, it depends on how good you are. All right, but let me try to just explain to you how this equation works in the 5 minutes I want to take, and then we'll go to lunch. Right? Why is C2 an eigenvalue in this equation? So to do that, I'm going to now transform the equation before your very eyes and make it something that we can actually solve. So I will now emasculate the equation. Right? So I have this problem has a number of problems to it. First, it's got this e to the d, which is horribly nonlinear. Let's get rid of it. Let's write e to the d minus 1. Let's write that as d. All right? Now the equation is linear, at least. Now it's a linear integral differential equation. That's already big progress. All right? None of these are approximations. This is just getting at the heart of the equation. All right? Let's make life simpler. This function cosh y minus 1, let's make that simpler, too. Let's call that mu cosh y minus 1, we'll write that as mu y squared over 2. All right? Why not? All right? And last but not least, I got this problem that this is a d. The relation between d and c is horrible. Right? Truly horrible. It's a non-local thing. Let's make it local. Right? So we're going to replace, I have this factor here, 2 to the k minus 2. Let's replace that by something a little nicer. Let's replace 2 to the k, what I call chi k, which is 2 to the k minus 2. We're going to replace it with no justification whatsoever as k minus 1. Why not? It's got to say it vanishes at k equals 1, notice. So this vanishes at k equals 1. It grows with k. It's the same thing between friends. Right? Now we've gotten to a point where we can actually solve the equation. Right? Now the equation is, when you go through this, now you rewrite it, you get the following equation. C prime equals minus mu y squared over 2 plus c2y plus epsilon y squared c double prime. So y c double prime, that came from the k squared, because now this is a second derivative operator. Right? In fact, it's an infinite derivative operator. That's, or even worse, because it's 2 to the k. That's the simplification I've made. All right? Now, that's a differential equation. Differential equations are good. Right? In fact, I can write down explicitly, you know, one solution of this differential equation is rather very simple. In fact, I can make this looks like a second order equation. If I now write g equals c prime, I can make it a first order equation, and then it's really simple. Right, because now I write g equals minus mu y squared over 2 plus c2y plus epsilon y squared g prime. And now it's a first order equation. And now it's an equation I can solve. finally. Right? First of all, I can write down an exact solution. G of y is mu y over 2 epsilon. That's obviously an exact solution. Why? You just plug it in. Right? Here you get mu y squared over 2 over 2 epsilon, and why is this an exact solution? Come on, guys. Take my word for it. For some C2. C2 has to be equal to mu over 2 epsilon, because there's an eigenvalue. That's the eigenvalue. For that choice of C2, then it works, because then you get mu y squared over, well, it works. This thing cancels that, and this cancels that. It works. Yeah. Okay, good. Now, well, how do I understand why? What's the general solution of this equation? And why does no other C2 work? All right. One way to see it, there are two ways to see it. The way for idiots and the way for sophisticates. I prefer idiot's way myself. The idiot way is you can write down a recursion relation for the power series expansion of G. Right? And you get the following thing. You get something that looks like this. G1 is C2. G2 is epsilon G1 minus mu over 2. I'm writing down the moment expansion again. Gi is I minus 1 epsilon Gi minus 1. Right? So now I can write down an exact solution of that recursion relation because it's a simple recursion relation. But the point is that what happens? Gi is I minus 1 Gi minus 1. So they're growing factorially, right? If it's growing factorially, it means, and this is the coefficients of the Taylor expansion, that means the radius convergence of the Taylor expansion is 0. The function is non-analytic at the origin. That is the problem. For an arbitrary C2, for an arbitrary choice of C2, the function is non-analytic at the origin. All right? And therefore, I have to, the only way to make this work is I have to, in fact, make the G's at some point all 0. And then it has a factorial growth times 0. That's OK. And in fact, that's how I get that. All right? That's the easy man's way. And the sophisticated man's way is you can actually write down the exact solution of this equation because it's a first order equation. And the answer is, drum roll, please, g of x, g of y is epsilon minus 1 over epsilon y, integral from a to y, e to the 1 over epsilon y, minus C2y plus mu y squared over 2 over epsilon y squared. Let's call this z because this is the variable of integration. Dz. That's the general solution of this equation. Okay? And now the condition is, the eigenvalue condition is an analyticity condition, which is very similar to what happens in the geometrical model of snowflakes. You can write down the solvability condition as an analyticity condition. What happens is here I have the function. Here there's an essential singularity at the origin, as you see, right? Which is obvious from the differential equation that there was an essential singularity at the origin. I have to find a solution that doesn't have the singularity. Right? So now let's consider what happens for negative y. Right? There are two ways. If I'm sitting here, for positive y's, this function is well defined. Now I have to go analytically continue. So I can go to negative y's this way. I can go to negative y's this way. They better give me the same answer. That means that the integral around here has to be 0. So I get the eigenvalue condition is just that. That's the condition on C2. Right? And that's the general structure. And I mean, even though I had to emasculate the equation, the point of the exercise is true. Even that you can now go, the point is that in general there's there is a essential singularity at the origin, and the reason that there's an eigenvalue is because that general solution therefore has an essential singularity, and there's one unique value of C2 for which there is no such singularity. That is a selected thing. So you have now a beautiful selection problem a la snowflakes, wonderful, except it's, you know, it's a complicated equation, you have to work hard, et cetera, et cetera. The only problem, and life is good. And so I thought we were done. Ready to write it up. This is gorgeous work. Check it. He wants me to check it. So you go back and check it now. Right? Does it actually work? Right? Well, I had done it for some small ends, and everything was looking great, fantastic. And then I finally developed enough strength that I could write a computer program to do these recursion relations in general, et cetera, et cetera. It's not such a trivial task. And I was much more interested in analyzing the beautiful equation than actually. But I saw it worked for 500, n's of 500, 1,000, so forth and so on, 2,000. Everything looked good. And then so I produced the graph of the velocity versus 1 over epsilon, which is just n over l, right? And let's do it in log scale. So let's do it a function of ln of this, right? And so it grows. You know, I mean, it grows linear, really linearly in n for small n's. That's fine, no problem. But down for large n's, it seems to be growing linearly. And then all of a sudden, it starts picking up some oscillations around n's of 10 to the 5th. And around n's of 10 to the 7th, there's no more solution. N over L, 10 to the 5th.
Yeah, but
that means if L is 100, N is 10 to the 7th. I mean, what do you want me to tell you?
Does it correspond to other parameters that you have in the problem or not at all?
No. No, there's no other parameter.
This is a calculation
of C2, the C2 eigenvalue, if you will, which is directly translatable to the velocity.
Yeah.
Right? As a function, for C1, I pick to be L over 2. I picked a particular C1.
Yes.
All right? Right there, I said C, it's slave to C1. I have to pick a C1. I picked this.
From your
eigenvalue. From this solving this high eigenvalue.
This moment
expansion.
Hierarchy.
Right. And the true answer looks like that. Keeps on going. So up to 10 to the 4th or something, it's you know, within a percent. And then at 10 to the 5th, there's you know like a 10% effect. And then by 10 to the 7th, there is no longer a solution. This is heartrending, heartbreaking. Because here I thought I was all done. And I thought it was just going to work perfectly, and that's the end of the story. And then all my terrible approximations that I had done along the way, like factorizing and all these things, were justified ex post facto by the fact that it actually worked. And then somebody I could go back in my leisure and clean up all that mess over the next 3 years. I'd have what to do, grand proposals galore, no problem. However, it decides to not work at some point. Shows you that life sometimes is just not fair. Because the first equation was C1 dot equals C2. So C2, that's the velocity. C2 is the velocity. Okay. So it's just I'm looking for the velocity of the traveling wave, like what we always do, right? Except that this is like more like dendrites in terms of it's an eigenvalue equation of some horrible mess than something simple, because this is much closer to that somehow. This is analytic, microscopic solvability in some sense, redux. All right. There is no further final answer. I can tell you what we did in the last 3 days, which might work. The question is, the only real approximation we did in all this game that's really serious is factorization. So it's got to be there because there's no other place for the goblins to be hiding, for the gremlins to be hiding, right? So we actually went back, and how do you start putting in the correlators? So there are an infinite number of correlators, the C2, C3, C5, C9, right? What we did is we put back the C2, Cn correlators. Right? If you look at the equation, so you have to write down an equation for the C2 Cn correlator. And you find that C2, V2, what we call V2n, which is the C2 Cn correlator. Right? This is the C2 Cn connected correlator. All right? It's C2 Cn minus the expectation value of C2 Cn. Right? Now you look at the equation of motion for that thing. And you find, not surprisingly, that in fact it's as bad as everything else. It's 2n plus 1. It's coupled to the one higher. It has its own hierarchy. And therefore, in the absence of the 1 over n effects, in fact, which is what we throw out, in fact, this would be badly behaved. Just like the original moment in hierarchy was badly behaved before we put in the 1 over n effects. So the 1 over n effects here are not a regular perturbation. They are as singular a perturbation here as they were in the original problem. So now we now have not only a selection problem for C2, we now have a selection problem for C2, which will drive this hierarchy. And in fact, that's what happens. I mean, we put in all the C2n correlators, and again, you drop some after some point, it doesn't matter. There's an eigenvalue condition for C2, 2, for V2, 2, which controls the V2n hierarchy, and you get a selection there. And there's also now, you put in the 3n things, there will be another hierarchy built upon V3-3. So there's another selection problem for V3-3. And another selection problem for V4-4. At some point, we're going to run out of steam. But at least, in principle, there is a selection hierarchy for all of these. So now we have an infinite hierarchy of selection problems. So we've gone the dendrite problem, not one better, but, you know, alphabet, you know, up to the next level. Instead of just having to pick one parameter, we now have to pick an infinite, there's a selection problem for an infinite set of parameters. And that's just at the two correlator hierarchy, assuming that there's nothing wrong with the third order correlators, which of course have their own hierarchy, which is again singular. So in fact, this is an infinite hierarchy of an infinite hierarchy of an infinite hierarchy. At some point, I don't, whether this will help with me practical way of analyzing this problem in the end of the day, I don't know. But at least, that's what it is. And you see that, in fact, if nothing else, I hope I've convinced you that A, discrete effects are singular perturbations and have to be dealt with, and B, that they're not trivial to be deal with them. Thank you.